people were getting ready to
Blog
go
talk
down.
Radio.
This isn't the way. We can't do it like this. Violence will break out and we will defeat our first.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later,
this is Bible study tonight, and I want to say to Chicago, death of Harold Washington was in Chicago on November 22nd. Happy birthday to you, Mary Hawkins. Got to wish her a happy birthday. Happy birthday to you, Chelsea Parker. And even Deborah, happy birthday to you. I want to say to you tonight that we want to talk about we want to talk about the death of John F. Kennedy in November the 22nd. And he was killed in Dallas, Texas, and he was shot in the head. And when they got him to the hospital, it was like a little pinhole in his neck, but his whole back of his head was blown off. You know, the violence stopped the killing phase of David. 2,000 people have been killed over in Israel where they're fighting at. If we're going to be a nation of love, we have to begin to stop the killing, save the babies. But men that are evil, I want you to read the 37th number of Psalms and 36, but not that stuff for you to do it. And I was talking to Bright Star tonight, Exodus 14, Pearl. I want you to get ready for Thanksgiving, and we know it's white magic, and I talked about white magic last night, and Brother Ray talked about it, and you said, well, Bishop, how do we get out of all this mess? By staying focused and reading your Bible and staying with God for your healing and your deliverance. God is still a healer, but you got to let go and let God. Exodus 14:14, God said, Moses, you step back. This is my fight. And when it's God's fight, when you pray, and ask God for a breakthrough, and he gives you the breakthrough, you got to let go and let God. Glory, hallelujah. Tonight is Bible study. If I talk about the Bible, I got to talk about the truth of the Bible. The death of John F. Kennedy was murder. The death of Mayor Harold Washington was murder. Rosalynn Carter, she passed. She lived a good life. Wages of sin is death, the gift of God, eternal life. Yes. I want you to know that God is set on the throne. He said how he looked low. I want you to know tonight there's a breakthrough coming for you. I want you to know tonight that God said high, but he looked low. I want to let you know God cleaned up upstairs, but he cleaned up downstairs. The storms and the floods coming, tornadoes, people flying, people driving, trying to get to grandma's house, trying to get to somebody's house. Because turkey dinner, the biggest holiday, I was telling Jerry, is Thanksgiving, because all the people, all the family come together. Now, I don't want to bust your bubble, because Thanksgiving is a winter solstice. That's where it is. Some of you don't even know what that means, but that's what's happening. Back in the day, they used to have in the big dinner bringing in the winter solstice. And they used to have a big day, okay? Now, these holidays are not black holidays. I know you're going to adopt it. The Native Americans always had a big dinner. Yes, they didn't have no turkey, Mary. They had buffalo. They had lamb. But the Europeans shot a turkey, and then they bought turkey. Everybody said, I got to have a turkey. Ain't nobody said they got to have some lamb or buffalo, because we've been programmed that when you do Thanksgiving, you're talking about turkey. It's a shame that we do stuff like that, and we don't exercise our truly gift. Now, with all these people coming, I want to say this, Mary, and say this to you. Bright Star, I say this for you, Karen and Lorraine. All the people, Pearl, coming over here from Foster City, they give them gym shoes, they give them telephone and money, they got tents. They won't even give blacks reparations. That means what our ancestors worked for, to sundown. But we ain't got reparations. We not even got the housing that they let these people do. You know, I want to say this here. What goes around, come around. If you work hard paying your taxes, here's some somebody come in and pay no taxes. But they're getting everything. Dr. King, I got a dream. I got a dream, too. My dream is that we will get up and be sound men and women. Stop the killing, save the babies. I'm getting ready for that. As we move down to Mississippi, Louisiana, where we go, prayer changes things. Psalms 93, Psalm 37, Psalms 28, Psalm 22. Kennedy lost his life November 22, Hal Washington, the first black mayor, he lost his life in November 22. And happy birthday to those that are having birthday today. And I want you to look up and live. Whatever you need, God got what you need. God got what you want. But I want to tell you, Pearl, come out of that old way. Get in the new way. You got to pull a chair up to cook, do it. Because God is a healer. Stop making excuses about your health. God is a healer. Body, mind, soul, and spirit. See, when you have not, because you ask not. You know, I want to say this tonight. The birth of a new man, a birth of a new nation. Not talk about Africa, Egypt. That doesn't happen. We done come a long ways, people. They handcuffed us and brought us over. A lot of our ancestors, I say, didn't make it. Because they fell off the ship. That's what happened. Mm-hmm. So I just want you to know that slavery is still real. So real. You have to understand that. The birth of you.
And the British. And all of these nations competed with each other to win the power of the Gold Coast so that they could exploit these people for commercial reasons and sell them into slavery. And finally, in 1850, Britain won out and she gained possession of the total territorial expansion of the Gold Coast. From 1850 to 1957, March 6th, the Gold Coast was a colony of the British Empire. And as a colony, she suffered all of the injustices, all of the exploitation, all of the humiliation that comes as a result of colonialism. But like all slavery, like all domination, like all exploitation, it came to the point that the people got tired of it. And that seems to be the long story of history. That seems to be a throbbing desire. There seems to be an internal desire for freedom within the soul of every man. And it's bad. It might not break forth in the beginning, but eventually it breaks out. The men realize that freedom is something basic. To rob a man of his freedom is to take from him the essential basis of his manhood. Take from him his freedom is to rob him of something of God's image. Paraphrase the words of Shakespeare's Othello, who steals my purse, steals trash. It's something nothing, 'twas mine, 'tis his, has been the slave of thousands. He who filches from me my freedom robs me of that which not enriches him, but makes me poor indeed. That is something in the soul that cries out for freedom. That is something deep down within the very soul of man that reaches out for Canaan. Men cannot be satisfied with Egypt. They try to adjust to it for a while. Many men have vested interest in Egypt. They are slow to leave. Egypt makes it profitable to them. Some people profit by Egypt. The vast majority of their masses of people never profit by Egypt. And they are never content with it. And eventually they rise up and begin to cry out for Canaan's land. So these people got tired. They had a long history as far back as 1840. time dominating the Gold Coast. They revolted, saying that they wanted to govern themselves. But these powers clamped down on them, and the British said that we will not let you go. About 1909, a young man was born on the 12th of September. History didn't know at that time what that young man had in his mind. Mother and father, illiterate, not a part of the powerful tribal life of Africa, not chiefs at all, but humble people. That boy grew up, he went to school at Archimota for a while in Africa. Then he finished there with honors and decided to work his way to America. He landed to America one day with about $50 in his pocket in terms of pounds, getting ready to get an education, and he went down to Pennsylvania to Lincoln University. He started studying there, and he started reading the great insights of the philosophers. He started reading the great insights of the ages, and he finished that and took his theological degree there and preached a while around Philadelphia and other areas as he was in the country. Went over to the University of Pennsylvania and took up a master's there in philosophy and sociology. All the years that he stood in America, he was poor. He had to work hard. He says in his autobiography how he worked as a bellhop in hotels, as a dishwasher. During the summer, how he worked as a waiter trying to struggle through school.
The original recording is briefly interrupted at this point.
I want to go back home. I want to go back to West Africa, the land of my people, my native land. That is some work to be done there. Got a ship and went to London and stopped for a while by London School of Economy and picked up another degree there. And then while in London he started thinking about Pan-Africanism. The problem of how to free his people from colonialism. For as he said, he always realized that colonialism was made for domination and for exploitation. It was made to keep a certain group down and exploit that group economically for the advantage of another. He studied and thought about all of this. One day he decided to go back to Africa. Got to Africa and he was immediately elected Executive Secretary of the United Party of the Gold Coast. He worked hard and he started getting a following. And the people in this party, the people who had had their hands on the plow for a long time, thought he was pushing a little too fast and they got a little jealous of his influence. So finally he had to break from the United Party of the Gold Coast, and in 1949 he organized the Convention People's Party. This party that started out working for the independence of the Gold Coast. He started out in a humble way, urging his people to unite for freedom, urging the officials of the British Empire to give them freedom. They were slow to respond, but the masses of people were with them, and they had united, become the most powerful and influential party that had ever been organized in that section of Africa. He started writing and his companions with him, and many of them started writing so much that the officials got afraid and they put them in jail, and Nkrumah himself was finally placed in jail for several years because he was a seditious man. He was an agitator. He was imprisoned on the basis of sedition. He was placed there to stay in prison for many years, but he had inspired some people outside of prison. They got together just a few months after he had been in prison and elected him the prime minister while he was in prison. For a while, the British officials tried to keep him there. And Bettimer says one of his close associates, the Minister of Finance, Mr. Bettimer, said that night the people were getting ready to go down to the jail and get him out. But Bettimer said, this isn't the way. We can't do it like this. Violence will break out and we will defeat our purpose. The British Empire saw that they had better let him out. In a few few hours, Kwame Nkrumah was out of jail. The prime minister of the Gold Coast was placed there for 15 years, but he only served 8 or 9 months. Now he comes out the prime minister of the Gold Coast. This was the struggling that had been going on for years. It's now coming to the point that this little nation was moving toward its independence. Then came the continual agitation, the continual resistance that the British Empire saw that it could no longer rule the Gold Coast. And they agreed that on the 6th of March, 1957, they would release this nation, that this nation would no longer be a colony of the British Empire. This nation would be a sovereign nation within the British Commonwealth. And all of this was because of the persistent protest, the continual agitation on the part of Prime Minister Kwame Nkrumah and the other leaders who worked along with him and the masses of people who were willing to follow. So that day finally came. It was a great day. The week ahead was a great week. They had been preparing for this day for many years, and now it was here. People coming in from all over the world. They had started getting in by the 2nd of March. 7 nations represented to come to say to this new nation, we greet you. And we give you our moral support. We hope for you God's guidance as you move now through the realm of independence from America itself. More than 100 persons, the press, the diplomatic guests, and the prime minister's guests. Oh, it was a beautiful experience to see some of the leading persons on the scene of civil rights in America on hand to say greetings to you. As this new nation was born, look over. To my right is Adam Powell. To my left is Charles Diggs. To my right again is Ralph Bunche. To the other side is Her Majesty's First Minister of Jamaica Manning, Ambassador Jones of Liberia. All of these people from America, Mordecai Johnson, Horace Mann Bond, all of these people just going over to say we want to greet you. And we want you to know that you have our moral support as you grow. Then you look out and see the Vice President of the United States. You see A. Philip Randolph. You see all of the people who have stood in the forefront of the struggle for civil rights over years coming over Africa to say we bid you Godspeed. This was a great day, not only for Nkrumah, but for the whole of the Gold Coast. Now, then came Tuesday, December the 5th. Many events leading up to it. That night, we walked into the closing of Parliament, the closing of the old Parliament, the old Parliament which was presided over by the British Empire, the old Parliament which designated colonialism and imperialism. Now that Parliament is closed. That was a great sight and a great picture and a great scene. We sat there that night, just about 500 able to get in there. People, thousands and thousands of people waiting outside, just about 500 in there. We were fortunate enough to be sitting there at that moment as guests of the Prime Minister. At that hour, we noticed Prime Minister Nkrumah walking in with all of his ministers, with the justices of the Supreme Court, the Gold Coast, with all of the people of the Convention People's Party, the leaders of that party. Nkrumah came up to make his closing speech to the old Gold Coast. With something old now passing away, the thing that impressed me more than anything else that night was the fact that when Nkrumah walked in, and his other ministers who had been in prison with him, They didn't come in with the crown that all of the promises came, but they walked in with prison caps and the coats that they had lived with for all of the months that they had been in prison. Cromer stood up and made his closing speech to Parliament with a little cap that he wore in prison for several months and the coat that he wore in prison for several months and all of his ministers round about him. That was a great hour. Old Parliament passing away. Then at 12 o'clock that night, we walked out. As we walked out, we noticed all over the polo grounds almost a half a million people. They had waited for this hour and this moment for years. As we walked out of the door and looked at that beautiful building, we looked up to the top of it. There was a little flag that had been going around the sky for many years. It was the Union Jack flag of the Gold Coast, the British flag, you see. At 12 o'clock that night, we saw a little flag coming down. And another flag went up. The old June Union flag, Jack flag came down, and the new flag of Ghana went up. This was a new nation now. A new nation being born, and when Prime Minister Nkrumah stood up before his people out in the polo ground and said, we are no longer a British colony. We are the free, sovereign people. All over that vast throng of people, we could see tears. And I stood there thinking about so many things. Before I knew it, I started weeping. I was crying for joy. I knew about all of the struggles and all of the pain and all of the agony that these people had gone through for this moment. After Nkrumah had made that final speech, it was about 12:30 now, we walked away. We could hear little children, 6 years old, and old people, 80 and 90 years old, walking the streets of Accra, crying, freedom, freedom. They couldn't say it in the sense that we said. Many of them don't speak English too well, but they had the accents, and it could ring out freedom. They were crying it in a sense that they had never heard it before. And I could hear that old Negro spiritual once more crying out, free at last, great God Almighty, I'm free at last. They were experiencing that in their very souls, and everywhere we turned, we could hear it ringing out from the housetops. We could hear it from every corner, every nook and crook of the community. Freedom, freedom. This was the birth of a new nation. This was the breaking loose from Egypt. Wednesday morning, the official opening of Parliament was held. There again, we were able to get on the inside. There Nkrumah made his new speech. As now the Prime Minister of the Gold Coast with no superior, all of the power that Macmillan of England has, all of the power the Nehru of India has, now a free nation. Now the Prime Minister of a sovereign nation. The Duchess of Kent walked in. The Duchess of Kent, who represented the Queen of England, no longer had authority now. She was just a passing visitor now. The night before, she was the official leader and spokesman for the Queen, thereby the power behind the throne of the Gold Coast. But now it's gone. It's a new nation now. And she's just an official visitor like M.L. King and Ralph Bunch and Coretta King and everybody else, because this is a new nation. A new Ghana has come into being. And now Nkrumah stands the leader of that great nation. And when he drives out, the people standing around the streets of the city, after Parliament is open, cry out, all hail Nkrumah. The name of Nkrumah crowning around the whole city, everybody crying this name, because they knew he had suffered for them, he had sacrificed for them, he'd gone to jail for them. This was the birth of a new nation. This nation was now out of Egypt and had crossed the Red Sea. Now it will confront its wilderness. Like any breaking loose from Egypt, that is the wilderness ahead. That is the problem of adjustment. Chroma realizes that. That is always this wilderness standing before you. For instance, it's a one-crop country, cocoa mainly. 60% of the cocoa of the world comes from the Gold Coast or from Ghana. In order to make the economic system more stable, it would be necessary to industrialize. Cocoa is too fluctuating to base a whole economy on that. So that is the necessity of industrializing. Chroma said to me that one of the first things that he will do is to work toward industrialization. And although he plans to work toward the whole problem of increasing the cultural standards of the community, still 90% of the people are illiterate. It is necessary to lift the whole cultural standard of the community in order to make it possible to stand up in the free world. Yes, there is the wilderness ahead. Oh, it is my hope that even people from America who go to Africa as immigrants, right back to the Gold Coast, and lend that technical assistance. For that is great need and rich opportunities there. Right now is the time that American Negroes should lend that technical assistance to a growing new nation. I was very happy to see already people who have moved in and making good. The son of the late president of Bennett College, Dr. Jones, is there starting an insurance company, making good, going to the top. A doctor from Brooklyn, New York, had just come in that week, and his wife is also a dentist, and they are living there now, going in there and working, and the people love them. There will be hundreds and thousands of people, I'm sure, going over to make for the growth of this new nation. And the informer made it very clear to me that he would welcome any person coming there as immigrants to live there. I don't think that because they have 5 million people, the nation can't grow, that that's a small nation to be overlooked. Never forget the fact that when America was born in 1776, when it received its independence from the British Empire, there were less than 4 million people in America. And today it's more than 160 million. So never underestimate a people because it's small now. America was smaller than Ghana when it was born. That is a great day ahead. The future is on its side. It's going now through the wilderness, but the promised land is ahead. Now I want to take just a few more minutes as I close to say three or four things that this reminds us of and things that it says to us, things that we must never forget. As we ourselves find ourselves breaking aloof from an evil Egypt, trying to move through the wilderness toward the promised land of cultural integration, Ghana has something to say to us. It says to us first that the oppressor never voluntarily gives freedom to the oppressed. You have to work for it. Living Chroma and the people of the Gold Coast had not stood up persistently revolting against the system, it would still be a colony of the British Empire. Freedom is never given to anybody. For the oppressor has you in domination because he plans to keep you there, and he never voluntarily gives it up. That is where the strong resistance comes. Privileged classes never give up their privileges without strong resistance. So don't go out this morning with any illusion. Don't go back into your homes and around Montgomery thinking that the Montgomery City Commission and that all of the forces in the leadership of the South will eventually work out this thing for Negroes. It's going to work out. It's going to roll in on the wheels of inevitability. If we wait for it to work itself out, it will never be worked out. Freedom only comes through persistent revolt, through persistent agitation, through persistently rising up against the system of evil. The bus protest is just the beginning. Buses are integrated in Montgomery, but that is just the beginning. And don't sit down and do nothing now because the buses are integrated. Because if you stop now, we will be in the dungeons of segregation and discrimination for another. will suffer all of the bondage that we have lived under for years. It never comes voluntarily. We've got to keep on keeping on in order to gain freedom. It never comes like that. It would be fortunate if the people in power had sense enough to go on and give up, but they don't do it like that. It is not done voluntarily, but it is done through the pressure that comes about from people who are oppressed. If there had not been a Gandhi in India with all of his noble followers, India would have never been free. If there had not been an Nkrumah and his followers in Ghana, Ghana would still be a British colony. If there had not been abolitionists in America, both Negro and white, we might still stand today in the dungeons of slavery. And it's been because there have been, in every period, there are always those people in every period of human history who don't mind getting their necks cut off, who don't mind being persecuted and discriminated and kicked about, because they know that freedom is never given out, but it comes through the persistence and the continual agitation and revolt on the part of those who are caught in the system. Ghana teaches us that. It says certain other things. It reminds us of the fact that a nation, part of people, can break loose from oppression without violence. Nkrumah says in the first two pages of his autobiography, which was published on the 6th of March, a great book which you ought to read, he said that he had studied the social system of social philosophy. He started studying the life of Gandhi and his technique. And he said that in the beginning, he could not see how they could ever get loose from colonialism without armed revolt, without armies and ammunition rising up. Then he says, after he continued to study Gandhi, continued to study this technique, he came to see that the only way was through nonviolent positive action. And he called his program positive action. And it's a beautiful thing, isn't it? That here is a nation that is now free. And it is free without rising up with arms and with ammunition. It is free through non-violent means. Because of that, the British Empire will not have the bitterness for Ghana that she has for China, so to speak. Because of that, when the British Empire leaves Ghana, she leaves with a different attitude than she would have left with if she had been driven out by armies. We've got to revolt in such a way that after the revolt is over, we can live with people as our brothers and our sisters. Our aim must never be to defeat them or humiliate them. On the night of the state ball, standing up talking with some people, Mordecai Johnson called my attention to the fact that Prime Minister Kwame Nkrumah and Nkrumah was there dancing with the Duchess of Kent. I said, isn't this something? Here is the one serf, the one slave, now dancing with the Lord on an equal plane. That is done because that is no bitterness. These two nations will be able to live together and work together because the breaking of loose was through nonviolence and not through violence. The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. This is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goals of justice and freedom. Let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation is completely crumbling, Montgomery, we will be able to live with people as our brothers. Oh, my friend, I must be not to defeat Mr. Engelhardt, not to defeat Mr. Sellers and Mr. Gale and Mr. Park. I must be to defeat the evil that ends up. I must be to win the friendship of Mr. Gale and Mr. Sellers and Mr. Engelhardt. We must come to the point of seeing that our ultimate aim is to live with all men as brothers and sisters under God and not be their enemies or anything that goes with that type of relationship. This is one thing that Garner teaches us, that you can break a loose from evil through nonviolence, through a lack of bitterness. And Cromer says in his book, when I came out of prison, I was not bitter toward Britain. I came out merely with the determination to free my people from the colonialism and imperialism that had been inflicted upon them by Britain. But I came out with no bitterness. Because of that, this world will be a better place in which to live. There's another thing that Garner reminds us. I'm coming to the conclusion now. Garner reminds us that freedom never comes on a silver platter. It's never easy. Garner reminds us that wherever you break out of Egypt, you better get ready for stiff battle. You better get ready for some homes to be bombed. You better get ready for some churches to be bombed. You better get ready for a lot of nasty things to be said about you, because you're getting out of Egypt, and whenever you break loose from Egypt, the initial response of the Egyptian is bitterness. It never comes with ease. Comes only through the hardness and persistence of life. Garner reminds us of that. You better get ready to go to prison. When I looked out and saw the prime minister there with his prison cap on that night, that reminded me of that fact. Freedom never comes easy. It comes through hard labor, and it comes through toil. Come through hours of despair and disappointment. That's the way it goes. That is no crown without a cross. I wish we could get to Easter without going to Good Friday, but history tells us that we got to go back Good Friday before we can get to Easter. That's the long story of freedom, isn't it? Before you get to Cana, you got a Red Sea to cross. You have a hardened heart of a fairy to confront. You have a prodigious hilltop of evil in the wilderness to confront. And even when you get up to the promised land, you have giants in the land. The beautiful thing about it is that there are a few people who've been over in the land. They have spied enough to say, even though the giants are there, we can possess the land, because we got the internal fiber to stand up amid anything that we have to face. The road to freedom is a difficult, hard road. It always makes for temporary setbacks. Those people who tell you today that there's more tension in Montgomery than there's ever been are telling you right. Whenever you get out of Egypt, you always confront a little tension. You always confront a little temporary setback. If you didn't confront that, you'd never get out. You must remember that. That's the tensionless period that we like to think of as a period when the Negro was complacently adjusted to segregation, discrimination, insult, and exploitation. And the period of tension is the period when the Negro has decided to rise up and break loose from that. And this is the peace that we are seeking, not an old negative, obnoxious peace, which is merely the absence of tension, but a positive, lasting peace, which is the presence of brotherhood and justice. It is never brought about without this temporary period of tension. The road to freedom is difficult. Finally, Garner tells us that the forces of the universe are on the side of justice. That's what it tells us now. You can interpret Garner any kind of way you want to, but Garner tells me that the forces of the universe are on the side of justice. That night when I saw that old flag come.
Everybody
said our being
What happened?
Took our flag away. We had the only American flag there. And they tore it down. They beat us up. Two paint on it.
What did you ask about the boys wearing a flower on one side of his shirt and a swastika on the other side? What did you ask them that?
Oh, what song will live as the main ship and the closer onto the shoreline? And the song will live back every face on the outer.
If you struggle with prostate or bladder problems, you need to see this.
I was looking through the peephole of the glass. As I was watching Dr. King, I saw him look over toward the boarding house. And then whenever he looked back, like he was going to look to the parking area, that's when he come up off of the grating, and that's when he was shot. I would say I was the only one that saw him get shot, actually get shot from the front. And it's not no pleasant sight. I felt very bad inside that this had to happen in Memphis, Tennessee.
The shame of Fireman George Lonergan watching Dr. Martin Luther King through a police spy hole at the moment of his death was soon to be shared by many as the weight of world condemnation came down on the city of Memphis on the 4th of April, 1968. This was the killing of a major world figure. How could they have allowed it to happen? There were even suspicions that the Memphis authorities were accessories to the murder and involved in a cover-up. Over 20 years later, the man convicted of King's murder, James Earl Ray, still protests his innocence. In this film, we showed new evidence that there was indeed a conspiracy and that the trail leads into the heart of government itself.
Your position is that you are...
Yes. I have no responsibility for it. I did commit certain, they probably considered criminal offenses, but they were nothing serious. I probably wouldn't know if I was in.
We are masters in our nonviolent movement in disarming police forces. They don't know what to do. I've seen them so often. I remember in Birmingham, Alabama, when we were in that majestic struggle there. We would move out of the 16th Street Baptist Church day after day. By the hundreds, we would move out, and Bull Connor would tell them to send the dogs for. And they did come. But we just went before the dogs singing, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." Bull Connor next would say, "Turn the fire hoses on." As I said to you the other night, Bull Connor didn't know history. He knew a kind of physics that somehow didn't relate to the transphysics that we knew about. And that was the fact that there was a certain kind of fire that no water could put out. We went before the fire hose. We had known water. If we were Baptist or some other denomination, we had been immersed. If we were Methodist and some other, we had been sprinkled, but we knew water. That couldn't stop us. And we just went on before the dogs, and we would look at them, and we'd go on before the water hoses, and we would look at it. We just go on singing, "Over my head, I see freedom in the air." And then we would be thrown into paddy wagons, and sometimes we were stacked in there like sardines in a can.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me. But we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand. We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed, that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is us. We're her problem. The only reason she has a problem is she doesn't want us here. And every time you look at yourself, be you black, brown, red, or yellow, a so-called Negro, you represent a person who poses such a serious problem for America because you're not one. Once you face this as a fact, then you can start plotting a course that will make you appear intelligent instead of unintelligent. What you and I need to do is learn to forget our differences. When we come together, we don't come together as Baptists or Methodists. You don't catch hell because you're a Baptist. Then you don't catch hell because you're a Methodist. You don't catch hell because you're a Methodist or a Baptist. You don't catch hell because you're a Democrat or a Republican. You don't catch hell because you're a Mason or an Elf. And you sure don't catch hell because you're an American, because if you was an American, you wouldn't catch no hell. You catch hell because you're a black man. You catch hell, all of us catch hell for the same reason. But we are all black people, so-called Negroes, second-class citizens, ex-slaves. You are nothing but an ex-slave. You don't like to be told that. But what else are you? You are ex-slave. You didn't come here on the Mayflower. You came here in a slave ship, in chains, like a horse or a cow or a chicken. And you were brought here by the people who came here on the Mayflower. You were brought here by the so-called pilgrims or founding fathers. They were the ones who brought you here. We have a common enemy. We have this in common. We have a common oppressor, a common exploiter, and a common discriminator. So once we all realize that we have this common enemy, then we unite on the basis of what we have in common. And what we have foremost in common is that enemy, the white man. He's an enemy to all of us. I know some of you all think that some of them are enemies. Time will tell. In Bandung, back in, I think, 1954, was the first unity meeting in centuries of black people. And once you study what happened at the Bandung Conference and the results of the Bandung Conference, it actually serves as a model for the same procedure you and I can use to get our problems solved. At Bandung, all the nations came together. There were dark nations from Africa and Asia. Some of them were Buddhists. Some of them were Muslims. Some of them were Christians. Some of them were Confucianists. Some were atheists. Despite their religious differences, they came together. Some were communists. Some were socialists. Some were capitalists. Despite their economic and political differences, they came together. All of them were black, brown, red, or yellow. The number one thing that was not allowed to attend the Bandung Conference was the white man. He couldn't come. Once they excluded the white man, they found that they could get together. Once they kept him out, everybody else fell right in and fell in line. This is the thing that you and I have to understand. And these people who came together didn't have nuclear weapons. They didn't have jet planes. They didn't have all of the heavy armaments that the white man had, but they had unity. They were able to submerge their little petty differences and agree on one thing, that though one African came from Kenya and was being colonized by the Englishmen, and another African came from the Congo and was being colonized by the Belgians, and another African came from Guinea and was being colonized by the French, and another came from Angola and was being colonized by the Portuguese. When they came to the Bandung Conference, they looked at the Portuguese and at the Frenchmen and at the Englishmen and at the other Dutchmen and learned or realized that the one thing that all of them had in common, they were all from Europe. They were all European, blonde, blue-eyed, and white-skinned. They began to recognize who their enemy was. same man that was colonizing our people in Kenya was colonizing our people in the Congo. The same one in the Congo was colonizing our people in South Africa and in southern Rhodesia and in Burma and in India and in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. They realized all over the world where a dark man was being oppressed, he was being oppressed by the white man. Where the dark man was being exploited, he was being exploited by the white man. So they got together under this basis that they had a common enemy. And when you and I here in Detroit and in Michigan and in America, who have been awakened today, look around us, we too realize here in America, we all have a common enemy. Whether he's in Georgia or Michigan, whether he's in California or New York, he's the same man. Blue eyes and blonde hair and pale skin. Same man. So what we have to do is what they did. They agreed to stop quarreling among themselves. Any little spat that they had, they settled it among themselves. Go into a huddle. Don't let the enemy know that you got a disagreement. Instead of us airing our differences in public, we have to realize we're all the same family. And when you have a family squabble, you don't get out on the sidewalk. If you do, everybody calls you uncouth, unrefined, uncivilized, savage. If you don't make it at home, you settle it at home. You get in the closet. Argue it out behind closed doors. And then when you come out on the street, you pose a common front, a united front. And this is what we need to do in the community and in the city and in the state. We need to stop airing our differences in front of the white man. Put the white man out of our meeting, number one, and then sit down and talk shop with each other. I would like to make a few comments concerning the difference between the black revolution and the Negro revolution. There's a difference. Are they both the same? And if they're not, what is the difference? What is the difference between a black revolution and a Negro revolution? First, what is a revolution? Sometimes I'm inclined to believe that many of our people are using this word revolution loosely without taking careful consideration what this word actually means and what its historic characteristics are. When you study the historic nature of revolution, the motive of a revolution, the objective of a revolution, and the result of a revolution, and the methods used in a revolution. You may change words. You may devise another program. You may change your goal and you may change your mind. Look at the American Revolution in 1776. That revolution was for what? For land. What did they want land? Independence. How was it carried out? Bloodshed.
Right.
Number one, it was based on land, the basis of independence. And the only way they could get it was bloodshed. The French Revolution, what was it based on? The landless against the landlord. What was it for? Land. How did they get it? Bloodshed. Was no love lost. Was no compromise, was no negotiation. I'm telling you, you don't know what a revolution is. Because when you find out what it is, you'll get back in the alley. You'll get out of the way. Come on in. The Russian Revolution. What was it based on? Land. The landless against the landlord. How did they bring it about? Bloodshed. You haven't got a revolution that doesn't involve bloodshed. And you're afraid to bleed. I said you're afraid to bleed. As long as the white man sends you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for white people. But when it comes time to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got no blood. You bleed when the white man says bleed. You bite when the white man says bite. And you bark when the white man says bark.